title fight, but had one other stipulation. The film had to have a star actor or a star producer. What about that guy who just directed that amazing movie, The Godfather? Coppola readily agreed. Lucas's space fantasy project was shopped a second time. When Universal agreed to take on Graffiti, Lucas sold his other ideas as part of the deal. The contract gave Universal options on Apocalypse Now and the Star Wars, although it would only have a chance to pick up the latter project if UA declined its option. The Star Wars was now named in a legal contract, not just a trademark document. Lucas was to get $50,000 for co-writing and directing Graffiti, a pay cut compared to THX. The budget was $650,000, also lower than that of THX. For enduring that ignominy, however, Lucas would get 40% of any profits. The American Graffiti shoot in July 1972 was a frenzied month of vampire hours, dusk till dawn. That one night the movie is set in would, for the cast and crew, happen 60 times. A nocturnal groundhog day. Lucas was not a night person, nor was he keen on dragging his crew back to Modesto. Instead, he chose San Rafael, and then, when it became clear the city was too noisy to stand in for the quiet town of his youth, the small farming town of Petaluma further up in Marin. At first, Lucas tried to be the cameraman as well. He really thought he could do it all. But the results looked terrible. So Haskell Wexler flew up from L.A. to help out, gratis. The story was simple. Two friends, Kurt and Steve, are class stars trying to decide if they're going off to college in the morning. Their other two pals are polar opposites. A hot rodder, Milner, who gets lumped with someone's kid sister for the night and is being pursued by an out-of-town hotshot driver, and a hapless scooter rider, Terry the Toad, who borrows Steve's car for a night and picks up a cute but demanding date. Lucas later suggested three of the friends represented aspects of his Modesto life. Terry was Lucas, the dorky comic-reading kid. Milner was Lucas, the Bianchina boy racer. Kurt was the junior college version, the Lucas who had knuckled down and was moving on to bigger and better things. Graffiti's story threads were united by Wolfman Jack, an actual contemporary DJ whose location no one knew, just as they didn't back in Modesto. It turned out Wolfman was broadcasting from a powerful tower down in Tijuana. The four stories intercut, an unusual idea at the time, as if viewers were bouncing between cars on radio waves. Wolfman himself appears at the end to help Kurt contact a mystery blonde he had glimpsed through a car window. It is the DJ as benign force, the voice that answers prayers, like Lucas's student film, The Emperor, but from the point of view of the radio audience. Coppola was wrapped up in Godfather publicity at the time and barely took part in the film he was nominally producing with Kurtz. But thanks to Fred Roos, a friend of Coppola's who also did casting for The Godfather, Lucas was gifted what may be the best cast of unknowns any second-time director has ever had. Ron Howard and Richard Dreyfuss stole the show. Then there was the guy playing Bob Falfa, the mystery driver who challenges Milner. He was a former bit player for Columbia who'd gotten out of the business and taught himself carpentry, which paid better. His name was Harrison Ford. And Kurtz had a set to with him about how much he had been drinking at the crew's Petaluma Motel before shooting the crucial drag race scene at dawn. "Don't show up like this again," Kurtz remembers chiding Ford, who stayed sober on the set from then on. Lucas wasn't about to stop the party, or give his cast much of anything in the way of direction. "The set was very wild, very loose," remembers Terry McGovern, who played a teacher. "George is not an actor's guy." McGovern had his hair cut hours before playing his scene opposite Dreyfuss when someone pointed out that teachers didn't have long hair in 1962. Another member of the cast, Charlie Martin Smith, remembers Lucas getting much more animated in describing his next movie than discussing the one at hand. "It sounded great to me," recalled Smith. "A big science fiction adventure with these short furry creatures called Wookiees. Richard Dreyfuss and I kept begging George to let us play them. Then he turned around and made the Wookiees 7 feet tall, which knocked us out of the running for that part. But for the most part, Lucas faded into the background like Wolfman Jack. He hid from the actors in most every scene, jammed under a diner's countertop, prostrate atop a car, and let the cameras capture what they would. He frequently fell asleep during a take. "I'm really going to direct this in the editing room," he told Ron Howard. And so he did, but not in his attic this time. He talked Coppola into buying a house in Mill Valley and turning its granny flat into an editing studio. Verna Fields was the main editor, but Marcia played a major role after Lucas pleaded, "I made it for you." It was a tough needle to thread. The cross-cutting between stories had to work perfectly, never losing the delicate mood of teenage fantasia. Getting the sound right was just as challenging. Lucas and Murch spent hours moving speakers to and fro in the garden of Coppola's Mill Valley house, trying to perfect the sound of a song heard from a passing car. The film soundtrack would be drawn from the songs Lucas had listened to in 1962, all except those by Elvis, who wouldn't give up the rights. They worked through cans marked with real, R, and dialogue, D, numbers. One night, Murch called out, "I need R2-D2. Lucas was amused. He was still a fan of curious letter-number combinations. R2-D2, the friends repeated, laughing. Lucas wrote it down in a notebook he'd started carrying around. By January 1973, Graffiti was ready for its preview. The Universal executives were invited to the screening, which was held in front of a packed house at the North Point Theater in San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf. Most of the audience loved the film, laughing throughout, but Universal's Ned Tannen hated it. A self-confessed manic depressive, he genuinely didn't see the warmth or the comedy. He wanted cuts. He threatened to release it as a TV movie. Coppola stepped in to defend his friend, offering to buy the movie from Tannen on the spot at cost, reaching into his pocket for a non-existent checkbook. As gallant a gesture as that was, it didn't work. Tannen refused to make a decision about releasing the movie. He seemed determined to keep Graffiti in limbo. Lucas was inconsolable. Once again, his child had been kidnapped by Hollywood. Again, he was deep in debt to his parents, to Coppola, to everyone. He went home and refused to return Universal's calls. Kurtz, meanwhile, had gone on scouting trips to the Philippines and South America to find the country most suitable as a stand-in for Vietnam on Apocalypse Now, as well as a country that could supply the maximum number of helicopters. While he was waiting, Lucas said, "He might as well start whipping up this treatment for my little space thing." It was time to bleed on the page like never before. 7. Home Free. When Lucas prepared to sketch out his space fantasy film for the first time, he wasn't alone. Across America, across the world, filmmakers were dreaming of similar projects. Just as THX 1138 was barely the first of numerous American dystopian movies in production in the early 1970s, Star Wars was one of a crop of ideas for speculative, fable-like space films, many of which were germinating as the decade progressed. The starting gun had been fired by Stanley Kubrick in 1968 with the $10 million epic 2001, A Space Odyssey. Audiences didn't get it back then, but filmmakers certainly did. Nascent talents like Martin Scorsese, John Carpenter, and Steven Spielberg were all sniffing around the science fiction realm, searching for a breakout mainstream hit, something that would follow the lead of Douglas Trumbull, the 25-year-old special effects technician Kubrick had hired for 2001, but in the service of a more accessible story. Lucas's success in this race was by no means assured. One of his closest friends had already conceived of a science fiction film that may well have been the successor to 2001. It almost snagged Steven Spielberg as a director. The project fizzled, but not before it propelled Lucas's film into hyperspace, providing the young director with the most important introduction of his career. Once upon a time, a USC film school graduate, was kicking around a treatment for a science fiction movie without a name. He was also dabbling in a computer language called BASIC. To help figure out what his movie should be called, he decided to write his computer program, BASIC. He would input hundreds of words he and his friends were using in the script, and the computer would spit them out in random 2- and 3-word combinations. When the printout came, most of it was garbage. But as he ran his finger down the list of names, one random combination stood out. The first word was star. The second was dancing. Star dancing. Coming soon to a theater near you. That's kind of cool, thought Hal Barwood. He took it to his co-writer, Matthew Robbins, and they tried the name out for a few months. Eventually, however, they decided they preferred one of the titles they'd come up with on their own, Home Free. That was the name under which their agent sold the treatment to Universal. So much for 2-word titles starting with star, humans 1, computerized name generator 0. Yet Barwood's computer program would eventually be vindicated, because every time this lost film has cropped up in the telling of the Star Wars story, it has been rendered as star dancing. Barwood spoke to me with the express wish that I set the record straight about the movie's name. Barwood and Robbins were key witnesses to every stage of the Lucas saga, the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to Lucas's Hamlet. They were friends with him at USC, introduced Lucas to their agent, Jeff Berg, rented rooms from him on the grounds of his million-dollar mansion in the mid-1970s, and were among the first few readers of early Star Wars drafts. Barwood later cropped up at Skywalker Ranch in his second career, making games for LucasArts, although he would not retire on the best of terms with his old friend or his company. Barwood, a New Englander who married his high school sweetheart, had been a science fiction fan from a young age. At USC, he made the award-winning short A Child's Guide to the Cosmos, 1964. When he graduated in 1965, he, like many USC film school alumni, went into industrial films. But he was haunted by an idea for an animated film he wanted to make called The Great Walled City of Zan. Barwood managed to wangle his way back into USC as a teaching assistant in 1967, just as Lucas was doing the same thing with the Navy class that filmed the first THX. In the following years, Barwood cemented his friendship with Lucas, Robbins, and Walter Murch. After graduation, Lucas would visit Barwood and his family in L.A. The two of them geeked out over film, animation, and science fiction. They played a 1970 game called Kriegsspiel, a more complex and warlike version of chess, played on hexagons rather than squares. "I beat him pretty regularly," Barwood remembers. The script, latterly known as Home Free, was written at the instigation of a producer named Larry Tucker, who just had a big hit with the 1969 swinger film Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. Tucker didn't exactly know what he wanted next, but he knew he wanted it to be science fiction, and he wanted it to be odd. He said, "Maybe there's an alien who jumps up in the air and comes flying down and sticks his nose into the ground like an arrow," Barwood recalls. We thought, "What the hell is he talking about?" What indeed? Science fiction, in its literary form, had gone in some wonderfully weird directions in the 1960s. At times, it seemed to be leading the way for youth culture. The decade kicked off with Stranger in a Strange Land, 1961, Robert Heinlein's seminal novel about Valentine Michael Smith, an Earthman raised by Martians. Returned to Earth, Smith finds he is a fish out of water, yet his psychic powers and sexually liberal attitude win many converts to his way of understanding, or grokking. He founds a church and tells his followers they are about to evolve into a new species, Homo superior. The free speech movement, the civil rights movement, the hippies, they all grokked it. 4 years later came another breakout science fiction novel, Frank Herbert's Dune. If Stranger in a Strange Land was a cult, Dune was a global religion. It is still believed to be the best-selling science fiction book of all time. Herbert built a universe in the space of a novel, specifically a galactic empire 210 centuries in the future, where computers are outlawed and great aristocratic houses are at war over access to a mystical, addictive spice that grants a user longer life and enhanced awareness. Dune centers on Arrakis, the desert planet where the spice is found, and it started a fad for desert planets. Hardscrabble warriors called Fremen are forced to harvest moisture from the atmosphere. A young aristocrat named Paul Atreides flees the massacre of his family, enters the desert, undergoes ordeals, takes the spice, and becomes a terrifying kind of messiah. As in Heinlein's novel, the figurehead of a new religion. There was a lot of that going on in the 60s. The sequel, Dune Messiah, 1969, showed a dark side to Atreides just in time for the Charles Manson murders. It took a while for Hollywood to catch up to the imaginative brand of science fiction in literature like Stranger or Dune. Science fiction movies ran roughly 20 to 25 years behind written science fiction, says Lucas's friend and filmmaker Edward Sommer. There were sound financial reasons for this. As great a critical impact as Forbidden Planet had made in 1956, if you've an ounce of taste for crazy humor, you'll have a barrel of fun, said the New York Times. The film took years to recoup its $5 million budget. The audience, it was thought, just wasn't there. Preteen boys like Lucas and his pals had rushed to see it, but the rest of the family hadn't. What chance did any other science fiction have? You'd exhaust the audience on the first weekend, and then you were in trouble, remembers Barwood of the conventional wisdom at the time. The received opinion in science fiction filmmaking was that you would make your money back only if you made a movie cheaply enough. James Bond could give you return on investment. Dr. Zhivago and The Sound of Music could give you a return on investment. But guys in astronaut suits just couldn't. So the 60s continued the trend of the 50s with low-budget schlock in the style of Roger Corman. While readers devoured Dune in 1965, theaters were still offering Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, cost $200,000. That was a big-budget epic by the standards of 1967's Mars Needs Women, cost $20,000. And so long as they were chronically undersupported by studios, there seemed little chance that science fiction or fantasy films would ever overturn the perception that the category was moribund by commercial and artistic standards. That state of affairs started to shift on April 3, 1968, when, by a startling coincidence, the two most important science fiction films of the decade were released on the same day. One was Planet of the Apes. The other was 2001, A Space Odyssey. Trying to imagine a world before either film existed is almost as hard as trying to imagine a world before Star Wars. Was there really a time our pop culture memory did not contain the line, "Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape"? Were we once able to hear the opening notes of Also Sprach Zarathustra without thinking of black monoliths, or the Blue Danube without seeing spinning space stations and zero-gravity stewardesses? 2001 was ultimately a more significant movie than Planet of the Apes. The obsessive, reclusive Kubrick, an idol of Lucas's on par with Kurosawa, had devoted 3 years of effort to this film, as had co-script writer Arthur C. Clarke. It was visual science fiction with as much music and as few words as possible. Its timing was exquisite. The special effects, which still hold up today, took audiences to the moon and beyond months before NASA had made its first lunar orbit. Then there was the final act, astronaut Frank Bowman's dialogue-free trip into the monolith on Jupiter, through death and rebirth, a mere year after the acid-soaked summer of love. The movie divided critics and audiences. In the United Kingdom, a young mime artist named Anthony Daniels, seeing his first science fiction movie, would walk out before the end. But the visual style of 2001 made a strong impression on one American filmmaker who preferred to tell stories with as few words as possible. To see somebody actually do it, to make a visual film, was hugely inspirational to me, Lucas said. If he did it, I can do it. At the time, however, Kubrick's masterpiece lost out to its release date rival. 2001 didn't make its $10.5 million budget back until it returned to theaters in 1975. It has since earned more than $100 million. Planet of the Apes was shot for half the cost and made $32.5 million at the box office that same year. Score another victory for small science fiction budgets. Critics went ape for Apes, too, and 20th Century Fox released a sequel every year from 1970 to 1973, followed by a TV series in 1974. Each one was weaker and cheesier and brought in fewer dollars than the last. But the original was pitch perfect and had much in common with 2001. Both films feature actors in monkey costumes, hunted astronauts, and profound paradigm-changing twists in their closing minutes. Both carry an implicit threat. Our technology, whether self-aware computers or atomic weapons, will be the doom of us all. But both films also hold out hope that we can evolve, either into smarter apes or into star-bound embryos. Between them, the two movies expanded the possibilities for the genre as never before, as did current events. When Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon 18 months later, the sense of wonder was infectious. All bets seemed to be off. Maybe there really were aliens who jumped into the air and stuck their noses in the ground like an arrow. Or maybe the breakthrough movie would have something to do with spaceships, holograms, the wave of the future. In 1973, another young, bearded USC graduate called John Carpenter filmed a semi-serious spoof of 2001 that focused on the claustrophobic confines of a long-haul starship. Its stir-crazy crew has adopted a bizarre beach-ball-like alien. It jumps in the air, at least. The movie was Dark Star, and it featured film history's first depiction of a ship going into hyperspace, created by Carpenter's friend Dan O'Bannon. Not bad for a $60,000 budget. Dark Star caught the attention of a frenetic independent filmmaker who'd made a couple of hallucinogenic movies of his own. The Chilean director Alejandro Jodorowsky, known as Jodo. Having bought the film rights to Dune for next to nothing, Jodo had come to Hollywood to try to persuade Douglas Trumbull to do the visual effects. Jodo wanted to open the movie with the greatest panning shot he could possibly imagine, across the entire galaxy, without a single cut, and figured the only one who could do it was the effects wizard behind 2001's spaceships. But Trumbull was arrogant in their meeting, interrupting Jodo several times to take long phone calls. The director walked out and went to see Dark Star instead. He was so impressed, he promptly arranged a meeting with O'Bannon. And after Jodo got him stoned on some particularly strong marijuana, O'Bannon agreed to pack up all his belongings, say au revoir to his wife, and move to Paris with him to work on the script. At that moment in the suburbs of Paris, a 15-year-old named Luc Besson was sketching out ideas for a space movie of his own. He would work on the script diligently for decades, and it would finally reach the screen in 1997 as The Fifth Element. Besson added one overt Star Wars reference, a female military officer with a Princess Leia hairstyle. Jodo, appropriately enough for Dune, was something of a cult leader himself. He persuaded the great Orson Welles to act as the villain of the piece in exchange for hiring his favorite Parisian chef, and even managed to hector Salvador Dali into agreeing to a cameo as the Emperor of the Universe for $100,000 a minute, Dali insisted. He got the Swiss artist H.R. Giger, possibly the only person in Europe weirder than Jodo and Dali, to do a bunch of nightmarish concept paintings, and recruited French comic book artist Mobius to storyboard the entire film at lightning speed. Taking the results back to Hollywood in 1975, he met with implacable opposition from the studios. Not to the storyboards, or to the idea of a Dune movie which had obvious potential, but to Hodo himself. His thundering insistence that it might be a 3-hour movie, or even a 12-hour movie if he felt like it, probably didn't help.
He'd already raised $10 million, but for want of an extra $5 million, Hodorowski's Dune was retired, never to be made. It would find new life in a 2014 documentary about the unfinished project, Hodorowski's Dune, from which most of these details are drawn.
The documentary's only sour note, it suggests that some scenes in Star Wars were inspired by Mobius' storyboards. Gary Kurtz insists he and Lucas never saw them, although he did later employ Mobius to draw posters for Star Wars' European release. Nevertheless, as with a lot of these failed 1970s space movies, its very existence would have some interesting, unintended consequences. Meanwhile, on the East Coast, yet another young bearded filmmaker, Edward Summer, had graduated from NYU's film school with dreams of making a science fiction film. He'd made a short film called Item 72D. Because everyone kept mistaking it for THX 1138, he added the subtitle, The Adventures of Spa and Fawn. While he waited to get funding for his other science fiction scripts, he opened a comic book store in Manhattan. Called Super Snipe, it soon became a mecca for comic book and film nerds, including Brian De Palma, Robert Zemeckis, Martin Scorsese, and their friend George Lucas. Years later, in 1999, the critic Peter Biskind wrote a book called Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. His thesis was that the rock and roll generation of directors split in two in the 1970s, that Spielberg and Lucas went one way into space fantasy and other popcorn fare, which changed the course of cinema and pushed out the edgier work of directors such as De Palma and Scorsese. But Biskind completely missed the fact that those edgy directors spent a good portion of the decade, just as Lucas did, in comic book stores, reading science fiction, trying to get space movies off the ground. The 1970s was a perfect storm for something like Star Wars to happen, Summer says. You remember Scorsese optioning stories by the great paranoid science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, while De Palma wanted to make a movie out of The Demolished Man, a science fiction classic by Alfred Bester. Everybody wanted to make a movie of The Stars My Destination, Bester's other hit novel, Summer remembers. I was involved with three separate productions of it, and nobody could get it right. The special effects were so difficult. Universal, more than most studios, had caught science fiction fever. The buzz around Home Free, built when Larry Tucker introduced Barwood and Robbins to a bright TV director named Steven Spielberg, who loved science fiction as much as they did, and was a protege of the head of Universal. But unfortunately, as Barwood, Robbins, and Spielberg were chatting excitedly about Home Free, Universal handed Douglas Trumbull a $1 million budget to shoot a movie of his own. Called Silent Running, it would use some visual effects shots that hadn't been completed in time for Kubrick's movie. Trumbull's plot seemed like it should appeal to space geeks, acid freaks, and members of the growing environmental coalition that had recently celebrated its first Earth Day. In the distant year of 2008, all plant life on the planet has been eradicated, save for a bunch of geodesic-domed greenhouses in orbit. Their gardener is given the order to destroy his cargo and return to Earth. Instead, he kills the crew and goes rogue with a pair of robots. Joan Baez sang two full songs on the soundtrack. It was something else. Home Free was to be something else, too. It had a little Forbidden Planet in its DNA, a little 2001, and a little something for the Stardust generation. It was the story of a space expedition checking out a couple of planets in a distant star system. Two guys are investigating the less interesting planet, the atmosphere of which is barely breathable. They scour its grassy plains in something like a giant RV. All of a sudden, the RV's computers start printing out the protocols for a first contact. It has detected alien life nearby. The protocols have been in the works for centuries and are inviolable. Accordingly, the senior guide departs for the other planet, leaving his underling behind as a guinea pig. The junior guy has a series of archaeological adventures on the planet, shades of Indiana Jones, while uncovering evidence of an ancient alien civilization. He can't find anything alive except a bunch of mysterious cleanup robots, which he brings back to the RV. They start disassembling the vehicle faster than he can put it back together. His oxygen starts running out. That's when the real aliens arrive, like the cavalry, to the rescue. "They're these angelic creatures," says Barwood. "They communicate with each other via light-emitting patches on their bodies, and they're sort of on vacation." The creatures recognize the astronaut is in danger, form a ring around his ship, start a dance, and, by powers beyond human understanding, lift the RV into orbit, where the young astronaut can be rescued by his compatriots. When Silent Running bombed at the box office in 1972, it was way too preachy, its protagonist insufferable. Universal lost all interest in science fiction. Home Free went to the graveyard of lost Hollywood projects. Barwood laments that the film would have cost too much to make anyway, and would probably have done better 30 years later, as a nice little CGI movie. Barwood went on to success with Steven Spielberg, for whom he and Matthew Robbins wrote his first main feature, Sugarland Express. After that, as we'll see, Lucas asked Barwood to co-write Star Wars, but Barwood turned him down. He did a lot of uncredited script polishing on Spielberg's own movie about a first contact, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, fleshing out the beginning and the end. Uncredited, too, was Barwood's impact on Star Wars, which may never have turned out the way it did were it not for a vital connection that Barwood provided to Lucas after his own space dream died. Back in his industrial film days, Barwood had worked on a series of movies for Boeing. The idea had been to promote a rival to the Concorde jet, itself another project that never came to fruition, called the SST for Supersonic Transport. At the aviation company, Barwood met an artist who'd done some amazing gouache paintings of the SST. The artist's name? Ralph McQuarrie. In 1971, while Barwood was still working on Home Free, he discovered that McQuarrie had moved to Los Angeles. They met to discuss the movie, and Barwood and Nobbins hired McQuarrie to create four concept paintings for it. Once McQuarrie had finished the first, he invited Barwood and Robbins to his studio one afternoon to make sure he was on the right path. The pair came over and brought their pal George Lucas, with whom they'd just been having lunch. The meeting that followed would quite literally change cinematic history. McQuarrie's painting, an astronaut next to an RV in a field of grass, stunned everyone. "Yes," they said, "he was on the right path." George looked at Ralph, recalls Barwood, and said, "You know, I'm going to make a science fiction movie. I'll remember you." Before he could afford to enlist McQuarrie's help in visualizing his space story, however, Lucas would have to sit at the kitchen table in his Mill Valley one-bedroom and struggle mightily to come up with the right words. 8. My Little Space Thing. How do you build a universe from scratch? It was a question George Lucas grappled with in 1973 as he sat down to hash out what exactly the Star Wars was all about. He had done something approximate in THX, and still carried notions of a sequel. But to do a THX movie was not really to tell stories. Lucas was now trying his hand at space fantasy, at storytelling on a galactic stage, and for that, he would have to relearn the art of writing. Lucas began by scribbling a list of names, just to see what they would look like written down. Emperor Ford Xerxes III, Xenos, Thorpe, Roland, Monroe, Lars, Kane, Hayden, Crispin, Layla. A baby name book in one hand, history books in the other, he added descriptions that wore their real-world inspirations too clearly on their sleeve. Alexander Xerxes XII, Emperor of Descartes, presumably a warrior philosopher king. Han Solo, leader of the Hubble people. Solo came from the paper cup brand, Hubble from the astronomer. Oh, and here's a good one. A name kind of based on his own. Luke Skywalker, Prince of Bebbers. This is the point at which you want to yell, "Wait, George, go back to those two names. Lose their ridiculous titles, dig up those R2-D2 and Wookiee names from your notebooks, and you'll be well on your way." But the course of creativity rarely runs smooth. Lucas focused first on another character, Mace Windy, a noble space samurai in the Kurosawa mode. Windy is a Jedi Bendu, a title which hailed in part from the name for samurai films, Jidai Geki, which actually just means period drama. The guy who will tell Mace's story, his apprentice or padawan, is either C.J. Thorpe or C2 Thorpe, nothing more futuristic sounding than a name with a number in it. Either way, his nickname will be Chewie, spelled C-H-U-I-E. Lucas had roughly one scene in his head at this point, although he wouldn't actually write it out for 3 years. He wanted to see a dogfight in outer space. Rather than stay static or move very simply in one direction the way models did in Star Trek, the ships would hurtle and tumble around after each other, like World War II fighters, like wild birds. For now, Lucas focused on the big picture questions. How to frame the movie that had been spinning in his head since USC, a movie that he now had to will into being, just the way he willed THX and American Graffiti into existence. Wills. That was it. Lucas saw an ancient order of galactic guardians called Wills. We wouldn't get to see them. They would be chroniclers in the background. The whole movie would be drawn from a book we never see. A book he could keep fleshing out for years if this little space thing worked. Journal of the Wills, he wrote. Part 1. This is the story of Mace Windy, a revered Jedi Bendu of Opachi, related to us by C.J. Thorpe, Padawan learner of the famed Jedi. Like many an amateur science fiction or fantasy writer, Lucas got bogged down in names, in planets and spaceships and interplanetary organizations, without first finding reasons that his audience should care about them. Thorpe hailed from Kissel. His father was chief pilot on the intergalactic cruiser Tarnak. Windy was warlord to the chairman of the Alliance of Independent Systems. Thorpe becomes his apprentice at the Exalted Intersystems Academy. Mired in detail after just a few paragraphs, Lucas decided to cut to part 2, 4 years later. Now Windy and Thorpe were guardians on a shipment of fusion portables to Yavin, where they were summoned to the desolate second planet of Yoshiro by a mysterious courier from the chairman of the Alliance. This was to be their greatest adventure. And then the narrative ended. The creator had 2 pages of a rough outline of the first in a series of films set in this new universe, but went no further. The man who finished every project he ever started was balking at the threshold of his hero's journey, which is, of course, exactly what a hero is supposed to do. While Lucas was staunching this latest bleeding, Universal still declined to distribute American Graffiti. William Hornbeck, one of the most respected editors in the business, called it totally unreleasable. Tannen had 2 scenes cut. Both scenes mocked authority figures. One in which Ron Howard's character Steve confronts his old teacher at the sock hop and tells him to go kiss a duck, and another in which Terry the Toad is accosted by a used car dealer. Lucas was apoplectic. His child was having her fingers cut off again, and sullenly refused to participate in the mutilation. Kurtz got Verna Fields to do the editing. In early 1973, while Graffiti was stuck in limbo, THX 1138 was shown on network TV. Newsday critic Joseph Gelmis loved it. The author of The Film Director as Superstar, Gelmis naturally wanted to know more about Lucas. Could he be a superstar? He arranged a preview screening of Graffiti and was baffled that the studio couldn't see its worth. He took the Lucases out to dinner in Sausalito and got the sense they were glad to have a free meal. What was Lucas working on next? Gelmis asked. Perhaps fearing the big-time movie critic would laugh at a Flash Gordon reference, Lucas called his new project a $4 million space opera in the tradition of Edgar Rice Burroughs. It was an attempt to push himself into the realms of plot, he said, the way graffiti pushed him into dealing with characters. In fact, when Lucas produced a second draft in April 1973, it was a kind of overcompensation for not liking plot all those years. A 10-page treatment, stuffed, suffused, and sprinkled with plot. It bore no relation to the Journal of the Wills 2-pager. Instead, it found its structure in a number of Kurosawa movies, most notably Hidden Fortress. Here we reach a favorite assertion of film nerds. Did you know Star Wars was based on Hidden Fortress? Except, no, it really wasn't. Lucas has acknowledged the influence of Kurosawa's long lenses and wide shots, and was happy to be interviewed for the DVD release of the Japanese movie in which he offers the faint praise that Hidden Fortress is his fourth favorite Kurosawa movie. But both he and Kurtz, who rarely agree on anything about Star Wars history, say the comparison between that film and Star Wars has been overblown. While Lucas had seen Hidden Fortress within a year of writing the treatment, this was 1973. He couldn't exactly rent the video and do a scene-by-scene analysis. All he did was copy the summary in Donald Ritchie's 1965 book, The Films of Akira Kurosawa, which became one paragraph in the treatment's introduction. Ritchie's summary reads, "It is the 16th century, a period of civil wars. A princess with her family, her retainers, and the clan treasure is being pursued. If they can cross enemy territory and reach a friendly province, they will be saved. The enemy knows this and posts a reward for the capture of the princess." Lucas's paragraph reads, "It is the 33rd century, a period of civil wars in the galaxy. A rebel princess with her family, her retainers, and the clan treasure is being pursued. If they can cross territory controlled by the Empire and reach a friendly planet, they will be saved. The sovereign knows this and posts a reward for the capture of the princess." Hidden Fortress focuses on two peasants in 16th century Japan, torn by civil wars. They were supposed to fight for a winning clan, but showed up late, were taken for defeated soldiers and captured, and then escaped. They bicker over which way to go next, split up, and are both captured again. Again they escape. After finding gold in a piece of driftwood by a riverside, they encounter its source, the defeated clan's general, and a supposedly mute girl hiding in a fortress in the mountains and hoping to move the gold out of enemy territory. The peasants tag along, hoping to earn or steal a share of the gold. The girl is revealed to be the defeated clan's princess, for whom the enemy has posted a bounty. She and the general use the gold to restore the clan's territory. The peasants end the movie with a single coin as a reward. Lucas's second treatment opened with a scene from a different story altogether. Deep space. The eerie blue-green planet of Aquilae slowly drifts into view. A small speck orbiting the planet glints in the light of a nearby star. Suddenly, a sleek fighter-type spacecraft settles ominously into the foreground, moving swiftly toward the orbiting speck. Two more fighters silently maneuver into battle formation behind the first, and then three more craft glide into view. The orbiting speck is actually a gargantuan space fortress which dwarfs the approaching fighters. Only after this foreshadowing do we cut to the paragraph cribbed from Ritchie's summary. An outlaw princess, a gruff general, and their treasure, priceless aura spice, Lucas wrote, his first reference to Dune, are traveling in land speeders across enemy territory. His first, but by no means his last. Science fiction geeks have noted the comparisons for years. Dune features Princess Alia. Both feature vehicles called sandcrawlers. The hardscrabble inhabitants of both Arrakis and Tatooine farm for moisture. Jedi Bendu may have been partially inspired by the self-control combat technique found in Dune, Prana Bindu. Two bickering imperial bureaucrats eject themselves from the space fortress, crash land on the planet below, and are captured by the general. The general's name, a favorite from Lucas's list, Luke Skywalker. It sounded like an old man, a Gandalf or a veteran samurai, ambling in the clouds with a walking stick. Lucas would never begin a single draft thinking of it as a name for a young hero. In a nod to Lucas's greatest influence, the treatment sent the small band toward a spaceport called Gordon. There, they hoped to find a spacecraft to take them to a friendly planet. Seeking shelter in a storm, Skywalker finds 10 lost boys in an abandoned temple. He overhears them plotting to attack the Empire in defense of the princess. Here, the treatment veers off entirely from Hidden Fortress. Skywalker trains these lost boys into manhood. The boys are angered at his cold and relentless directions, although they grow to respect him when they begin to see the results of his training, Lucas wrote, in what may have been his most accurate description of his relationship with his father. The band of rebels reach Gordon. Here we get the one scene that was to survive unaltered through all drafts and into the movie. The group enters a cantina, hoping to find a contact that will yield passage off the planet. The murky little den is filled with a startling array of weird and exotic aliens laughing and drinking at the bar, Lucas wrote. A group of aliens lays into one of the boys, and Skywalker is forced to take his laser sword from its sheath. In a matter of seconds, an arm lies on the ground. So far, so exciting. But the pace continues exhaustingly, with no slow beats. The rebels are led into a trap by a traitor, steal a space fighter, battle Imperial ships across half a galaxy, hide in an asteroid, are attacked again, and crash land on the forbidden planet of Yavin. And that's just one paragraph. Yavin brings us aliens riding on giant birds who capture the princess and sell her to the Empire. Skywalker and the boys fashion jet sticks from their rescue packs. A mob of aliens throw Skywalker into a boiling lake. He clings to a vine, finds the lost boys with the help of an alien farmer, attacks an Imperial outpost, learns the princess has been taken to the Empire's home planet, and trains the boys again, this time, to fly one-man fighters. They fly into the prison complex, blast their way to the princess, and take her to the friendly planet they were aiming for in the first place. There's a parade. The bureaucrats see the princess revealed as her true goddess-like self, and then go and get drunk. The end? Lucas wrote, leaving the door open to sequels and echoing Look at Life. We're as far from Hidden Fortress here as we are from the finished Star Wars. Lucas offered many nods to other Kurosawa movies. General Skywalker encountering the boys in the temple echoes a scene in Yojimbo. The cantina scene is inspired by the sequel, Sanjuro. It's pretty dense stuff, even for a seasoned Star Wars fan reading it in hindsight. For someone not attuned to science fiction, it's pretty much impenetrable. Lucas's agent, Jeff Berg, found it incomprehensible. Still, he had no choice but to show the treatment to United Artists and Universal. If Lucas was trying to produce a treatment that would get him out of his obligation with both studios, he couldn't have done better. Clearly, this picture was going to cost more than $4 million. David Picker at UA, which still had the first option on the film, rejected it out of hand. It would take a few more months for the studio to release its trademark on the name The Star Wars. In June, Berg sent the treatment to Universal, which held the second option, accompanied by a terse note. If the company wanted it, it had 10 days to say yes. Universal never actually turned Star Wars down. It just didn't respond. Universal would make nice with Lucas soon enough, taking an option on another treatment he wanted to develop, called Radioland Murders. With UA and Universal both having passed on the Star Wars, Lucas was free to shop his treatment around other studios. He took it to Disney, but that studio was a walled castle producing few great movies at the time. 1973's Robin Hood was the exception, and beginning what would become a decade of decline. Disney would have accepted this movie if Walt were still alive, Lucas insisted. Ironically, Disney would never get its hands on the film, not even after it bought Lucasfilm some 4 decades later. The original movie is the only Star Wars film to be distributed by another studio in perpetuity. The lucky studio, of course, would be 20th Century Fox. In 1973, it was the home of the last successful big-budget science fiction adventure, Planet of the Apes. More importantly, it had taken a keen hunter of talent in the form of its new vice president of creative affairs, Alan Laddie Ladd Jr. Laddie was the son of a Hollywood star, a former agent, and a former producer. He was shaking things up at Fox with his contractual ability to give movies the initial go-ahead to start production using the studio's money, or greenlighting, as Hollywood calls it. The first movie Laddie greenlit was Young Frankenstein. The second was The Omen. Both would become monster hits. To interest Laddie in Lucas, Berg managed to get him a print of Graffiti. Laddie loved the film so much, he asked Berg if there was any way Fox could buy it from Universal. Berg communicated this to Tannen, which in turn spurred Tannen to finally schedule the long-suffering movie for a summer release. A fair number of falsehoods have clustered around Laddie's role in Star Wars over the years. One myth is that he was president of the studio at the time. In fact, he wasn't even on the board of directors. Another is that Laddie couldn't understand what Lucas was talking about when the young director tried to explain Star Wars and merely decided to bankroll him based on his passion for the project. "Not true," he says. "I understood completely," remembers Laddie, now 76. "He explained it to me in terms of other films." Flash Gordon was not one of them. Evidently, Lucas had already solidified his lifelong habit of discussing Star Wars differently depending on who he was talking to. For Laddie, his influences were old Errol Flynn capers such as The Seahawk, Robin Hood, and Captain Blood. Star Wars would borrow their sense of adventure, their bloodless deaths, their clearly delineated conflict between good and evil. Even now, Laddie keeps spotting echoes of the movie in old Hollywood, such as the Gene Kelly version of The Three Musketeers, 1948, which ends with a medal-giving ceremony very similar to the medal-giving on Yavin 4. Others have looked at this ceremony and seen a similarity to Leni Riefenstahl's 1938 Nazi documentary Triumph of the Will, which Lucas has said he saw in the late 1960s, but he dismissed any connection. "Like everyone else, he stole from what he loved," Laddie says. But there were ways in which Lucas was clearly exceptional. "He was a very intelligent human being. I was very impressed with his brain. I believed in him completely." On July 13, 1973, Laddie snapped up the Star Wars in a deal memo that gave Lucas $150,000 to write and direct. The memo also gave Lucasfilm a budget of $3.5 million and 40% of the movie's profits. It stipulated that sequel rights, soundtrack, and merchandising would be negotiated before production got underway. Star Wars legend has it that these were inconsequential things, known to Hollywood lawyers as the garbage. Few films got sequels. Even fewer sequels made money. Soundtracks didn't sell unless they were musicals. Merchandising for movies? Impossible. That said, the fact that the lawyers would keep fighting over the precise details for the next 2 years shows that Fox was not as asleep at the switch as we've been led to believe. Even turning the deal memo into an actual deal took a few months. Meanwhile, in August, Graffiti was released, and Lucas's life would never be the same again. It was a hit, and not just one of those slow-to-build indie hits, but the kind for which Variety reserved its finest neologisms, Sacco and Boffo. It opened strong in New York and L.A., and lost no momentum as it spread across the country. This was summertime. There were still drive-in theaters, and this was the perfect drive-in movie for hot summer nights. You saw it and felt 17 again. Graffiti would make $55 million that year. When it was reissued in 1978 after Star Wars, it made another $63 million. By the 21st century, its take would exceed $250 million. Given that its budget was $600,000, the film gave Universal and Lucas one of the greatest returns on investment in movie history. Lucas's agent knew he could get another $500,000 up front for the Star Wars, at the very least, if he renegotiated his fee with Fox. Instead, his client wanted to press the case on his rights to the garbage. By the end of 1973, to his great surprise, George Lucas was a millionaire small business owner. After taxes, American Graffiti earned $4 million for Lucasfilm that year. In 2014 dollars, that's $16.5 million. It was an astonishing turn of events for a couple in a one-bedroom in Mill Valley who were getting by on less than $20,000 a year with both of them working. But the Lucases weren't about to copy Coppola, who had moved into a massive Pacific Heights mansion and started leasing a jet after the runaway success of The Godfather. For one thing, they had to pay debts back to just about everyone they knew, including Coppola and George Lucas Sr. Then the couple spent cautiously. They moved further into Marin and paid $150,000 for a one-level Victorian mansion on Medway Road in San Anselmo. Working from old photographs of the house, Lucas reconstructed a second-floor tower with a fireplace, wraparound windows, and view of Mount Tam. Inside, he made a desk out of three doors. Drafts of all six Star Wars movies would be written on its surface. In October 1973, Lucas began loaning his wealth to a shell company, the Star Wars Corporation. Marcia was away in L.A. and Tucson, editing Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore for Martin Scorsese. He visited Tucson a few times, feeling a little protective. Scorsese had a rowdy reputation. Lucas brought hefty tomes with him, Isaac Asimov's Guide to the Bible, and a giant study of mythology called The Golden Bough by the 19th-century anthropologist Sir James George Frazer. The Golden Bough was enjoying something of a revival in the 1970s. It aimed to boil down all religious beliefs and rituals to their common elements, but Frazer's prose requires something of an effort to slog through. Scorsese asked Lucas, "Why all the heavy reading?" "I'm tapping into the collective unconscious of fairy tales," Lucas explained. Back home, he retreated to the writing tower at 8 every morning. His goal was 5 pages every day. When he finished, his reward was music on the Wurlitzer jukebox. Usually, he got 1 page done by 4 p.m. and reached the rest of his target out of sheer panic in the next hour, in time for the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. The news offered little respite. The world seemed to be falling apart. The ceasefire in Vietnam broke down. U.S. troops were heading for the exits. Watergate engulfed the Nixon White House. The Arab nations attacked Israel again. OPEC was withholding its oil. Suddenly, even millionaires like Lucas had a hard time filling their cars. Lucas channeled the news into his notes. With Apocalypse Now on hold until Coppola, then just its producer, could persuade a studio to fund it, the Star Wars became the only place he could comment on present-day politics. Thus, the planet of Aquilae becomes a small, independent country like North Vietnam, he wrote in late 1973. The Empire is like America 10 years from now, after gangsters assassinated the Emperor and were elevated to power in a rigged election. We are at a turning point. Fascism or revolution? Politics blended with escapism. Lucas bought armfuls of comic books again. Jack Kirby, the best-loved comic artist in the United States, had just finished a series called The New Gods. The hero uses a mysterious power called the Source. The villain is called Darkseid, a black armor-plated character. He happens to be the hero Orion's father. Away those influences went into the filing cabinet of Lucas's brain. Lucas had never been a particularly avid reader of science fiction novels, but he made a serious effort now. There was one 1960s author for whom he had always made an exception, Harry Harrison, a former illustrator and former Flash Gordon comic strip writer. Harrison offered stories that could be read on two levels, rollicking space adventures and satires of the science fiction genre. Bill, the Galactic Hero, 1965, spoofed Robert Heinlein's masculine tales of space soldiers. The Stainless Steel Rat was a series of novels whose protagonist, Jim DeGrisse, is a charming rogue and interstellar con man, in it for the fun of it, a proto-Han Solo. By the time Star Wars came out, Harrison was in Ireland, trying to eke out a tax-free living from his novels. The film rights to his 1967 classic Make Room, Make Room had been sold to MGM for $1 by an unscrupulous lawyer. MGM turned it into Soylent Green. In the early 1980s, Harrison read in an article that Lucas loved his work and became apoplectic. I thought, well, Why the hell didn't you write to me and have me do a goddamn script for you, you know? If that's what you feel, old son, I'd be very happy to come over and make some money from this rotten field. Oh, there's no justice. When he was writing Star Wars, however, Lucas wasn't really thinking about making money from the rotten field. He was just absorbing its pulpier classics. Though he long understood Burroughs to be a primary influence on Flash Gordon, Lucas only read